Right, let's make sure you are in fellowship. If somebody got you out, now's the time to rebound. And be prepared to continue moving on here, dealing with this matter of the great golden cup in the hand of the Lord, that Babylon has been, and it still is in many, many ways. Still intoxicating the earth with our viewpoint. And we are on point 21 here, dealing with this matter of why the Protestant biblical approach to reason, freedom, and capitalism is superior to what we see in other nations, other religions, and that there are certain proofs that if one looks at this pretty carefully, that there are proofs as to why this nation has done better than other nations. And of course, at the end of the day, we would simply say because God's blessed us more than he has other nations. But there are reasons for that. Why is God more amenable to that certain viewpoints, like personal freedom and all of that, rather than a feudal system of slavery? Well, again, Paul said, stay in your niche wherever you are. If you're a slave, don't worry about it. Remain a slave. But if you can get your freedom, he said, take it. And so, obviously, God is for freedom, big time. Well, we got down to point E here. The Catholic Church essentially had a legal monopoly in the South. And again, this is everything south pretty much of the Rio Grande. But it was weak because of its politics and the fact that it lacked popular support among the natives. But again, how did these Spaniards operate? If you go up there to St. Augustine, there's a fort up there. And it sits, right down pretty much on the bay. And, it's elevated a little bit so you can see out, but they basically, when they ran into these natives and all of this, Spaniards, a lot especially, basically said, do you want to convert to Catholicism? If they said yes, fine. If they said no, they killed them. So you can imagine they weren't popular with the natives to speak of with that sort of approach. Now, maybe we try that approach in evangelism. No, I'm kidding. We wouldn't do that. Believe or die, so that's not God's way. Well, however, the extensive pluralism that developed in American history not only fostered competition among the denominations, that has actually, over the course of our history, while a lot of infighting and religious denominationalism isn't necessarily a good thing, it forces them to consider their theology, and it kept them sharper, frankly. Where you've got a monopoly, you don't have to worry about it. But where you have to compete for an audience, then you've got to start thinking about your theology, what you're doing, what you're offering people. And essentially, Catholicism offers people slavery. You become a slave to the Pope and whatever he says. And that's really what it is deep down. So it produced an unmatched level of religious commitment and cultural influence. So, rather than looking to the government for support, the denominations in the U.S. kept their distance from the state. And many of them made huge investments in educational institutions. How did this help? Well, obviously it helps if you've got a more educated populace. Theoretically, of course, the more educated you are, the better you can reason, the better decisions you can make, the more information you have. We recognize that in some ways, information is power. If it's used properly, of course. So many, while one may not believe it today, Harvard, William & Mary, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, Brown, and Rutgers were founded to combat governmental abuses of power. And now they're just cranking out people to abuses in many of these institutions. But that's why they were started initially. And that was a good thing. Which they believed could be accomplished by eliminating biblical illiteracy. Their real emphasis was on people learning and knowing the Bible. Now, that's changed, obviously, as we know. But to recognize that, that is a good thing in your history. That the educational institutions were primarily, their purpose was to teach people the Bible. So they would know it. So, again, America defies really easy description in terms of our history because it is so checkered. There's obviously, alongside this, there existed certain evils at that time and all of that. Well, this encouraged reading, free thinking, and independent. Well, we don't want that. That's all wrong right there. You can't have that. which resulted in a biblical influence that was characterized by rational theology. That influence promoted the virtues of honesty, diligent labor, thrift, and self-reliance. And guess what? Those are qualities that make for a great nation if their people have them. And this is exactly what came out of the early stages of these of the country. So 22, in spite of these things, there's still an argument about whether America was founded on Christian principles, again, or whether it was designed to be a Christian nation. In a very thoroughly researched article by Mark Hall, he explores those questions, which have two popular answers that are in conflict. Some immediately say, of course not. America wasn't meant to be a Christian nation. Separation of church and state, that's all it's about. And others say, absolutely, yes, America was designed to be a Christian nation. And again, most of the people who hold to that viewpoint tend to be conservative, fundamental, orthodox believers. Now, not all of them, but many of them are. And those who don't tend to be secularists of various types and ilks, humanists, religious liberals, who say, no, we do not want any religious influence in America, and so therefore we want to wipe out any idea that there's been any. And so they want to undermine all this. Well, A, he rightly notes that this is a complex issue, which is not easily resolved. I like that when I read a writer who admits right off the bat that things aren't black and white and simplistic. And particularly when you're dealing with hundreds of years of history. And basically what happened. So he also notes that those that answer in the negative have their reasons, while those that answer in the affirmative have their reasons. So he says both sides make a good argument. And that's a sign of an even-handed reporter, rather than just bashing one side or the other. Well, many argue that the founding fathers were largely deists, guided by secular ideas, self-interest, class, and other interests of the state. Well, at a certain level, that's true. That is true. But is that the totality of it? And I don't think it is. On the other hand, their opponents argue that virtually all the founding fathers were devout, orthodox Christians who consciously drew their religious convictions to answer most, drew from their religious convictions to answer most moral and political questions. Unfortunately, both sides often tend to cite the sources that support their view and reject those sources that do not provide support. That's human nature. People are going to defend their view, and they'll ignore the other material. And this is where intellectual honesty comes in. This is a part of rational reasoning, that you have to be intellectually honest and discerning, that God does not want his people to be stupid. My people perish for a lack of knowledge, he said in Hosea. And we're going to make sure, at least to the extent that I can, and the jury's still out on all of us, I'm never confused on that one at this point. But as much as I can do it, I'm going to make sure you get all the knowledge you can handle in Bible class. You're going to get, as much as I can, 5 solid hours a week, not 5 30 or 40 minute classes, or 3. Or 3 points, a poem and a prayer. And as life said, I'm not going to get up here and go through the motions. If I can't do this in good conscience, if I'm not prepared, if something's going on, I can't do it, I will flat out tell you. But most of the time I can. And God blesses all of this, and I've been very pleased with it all, very happy. Sure, there's testing, and there's all kinds of things that make you want to throw in the towel, but we're awfully close to have run this race a long time to start thinking about quitting now. Most of us have. Most of us here have been at this for a long time. And I'm here to encourage you to keep running, right to the end. Don't give up now. It's too late. We're here at the very finish line. You can see it coming, as it were. If you can see the day approaching, all the more then. So, and that's what we've sought to do here. So those that accept a Christian foundation, point E, seem to think that if the founding fathers uttered anything religious at any time in his life, that made him an orthodox Christian founder. Well, people say all manner of things. And a matter of fact, if you do some research into music today, we were discussing this here last week. There are many people out there who are complete unbelievers, but they write lyrics that are designed to appeal to a bigger audience than just who they want. They don't want to say, well, we want to rule out Christians as a part of our audience, because that's a big segment of money, frankly, to rule out of your constituency. And so they'll write songs that if you listen to them, you think, well, that's a believer singing. But in most cases, many cases, they're not. Then there are others. So there's a guy I particularly like. His name's Matt Hyers. His new album is called American Wilderness, and it's really pretty good. But it's written from the perspective of a Christian who, he actually is a believer, but who finds it difficult, and living in America in the last days is challenging to his faith. And so he writes certain things about how hard it is. There's a song in there called Holy War. This holy war better be worth the fight. And so, but he actually is a believer, but he writes about the Christian struggle, that it isn't always easy. One of the first song on there is about fighting the sin nature. It's called Fighting a Ghost. Can't see him, but there I am. Well, so again, just because somebody says something that sounds Christian or they slap Jesus on it, don't drop your discernment and immediately conclude that, hey, they're all okay. Stop and consider and think about and recognize that, okay, this might be this, it might be that. I've got to be careful. F, those that believe the founders were mostly deists who do not believe that God interferes in the affairs of men or nations, viewed religion, and particularly religion's relationship to government, through an Enlightenment lens that was deeply skeptical of Orthodox Christianity. That's out of a book by Frank Lambert there, The Founding Fathers and the Place of Religion in America. And again, I've got the footnotes in here, so if you see those numbers, you can just mark them up and match them up, rather, and check these out. Some of these things are available online, some are not. Usually what I try to do is glean through it and get the best points that need to be made. I'm certainly not going to get up here and read books to you, or even lengthy passages out of books. I'll do the research and pare it down. But, you know, you take a 300-page book and pare it down to 10 or 12 points, obviously you have to really focus on what's the real important stuff here. And that's what I try to do, is stick with that. So Hall recognizes that both views have significant problems, and that neither view completely and accurately reflects the history of the men that were involved in the founding of this nation. And he goes on to say, if one is to understand the story of the United States of America, it's important to have a proper appreciation for its Christian colonial roots. By almost any measure, colonists of European descent who settled in the New World were serious Christians, whose constitutions, laws, and practices reflected the influence of Christianity. And obviously, and again, as we pointed out, alongside all of this, there's a bit of evil going on under the surface. But that doesn't mean that this isn't happening too. That evil and good coexist side by side sometimes. And so you have to look at these things carefully and consider them. So 24, without endlessly debating the specifics, it is apparent that many of those who forged this nation's documents and laws were God-fearing people with a basic Christian outlook. Even if they weren't full heart, we might call hardcore positive believers, but they had a basic Christian outlook. See, the outlook and the viewpoint of life that people have, their worldview, obviously has undergone a lot of change in this country. It's undergone a lot of change since 1950. People's worldview and how they look at things. And so that's always going on to some extent. But these people were basically had a Christian outlook. They believed in a God. As far as they knew, the God of the Bible mostly. And they didn't have to understand everything or be perfect. They're not theologians. They weren't meant to be. They're trying to start a country. Well, A, the Declaration of Independence states that all men are created equal. Endowed by their what? Holy crap, this can't be evolution. Endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And while it is an exaggeration to say that all the founding fathers were Christians, it is apparent that many of them acknowledged the truthfulness of the Bible and the authority of the creator over his creation. That you can't miss. So, and that's a basic fundamental Christian outlook, that there is a God, that he does care, that he is involved in history, and that he works and takes care of his people. So they believe that God ordained moral standards. Well, see, now today, we want our worldview today, not ours, but the general cosmic worldview in Babylon wants to throw these out. We don't need moral absolutes. This is not a good thing as they see it. These are restrictive. This keeps you from being an LGBTQ queer PB, whatever it is. You know? But that is a basic fundamental flawed outlook that says people are, well, God doesn't even know what he's doing, frankly, let alone people. So that legislation should be made in accordance with these same standards, and that moral laws took precedence over human laws. That was their fundamental view. And that view is correct. Moral law does take precedence over human laws, which are flawed. And when you look at the human law system, of course, we're buried in them. You've got so many laws, you couldn't know all of them. And you're probably in non-compliance with some of them. Who knows? If you know every little detail of the law, which I don't. I mean, generally speaking, I know you're... And yeah, but all of this is solved by biblical Christianity. You don't have to worry about the law if you love your neighbor as yourself, do you? Because perfect love, against that love, there is no law. So if I'm applying Christianity, if I'm applying the Bible and treating my neighbor right and doing the right things, I don't need a lot of laws to tell me how to live. In fact, I don't need any. And what Paul said, the law, know this first of all, that the laws were made for the unrighteous and the ungodly. And the sinners. Laws aren't made for... The righteous person doesn't need a law. He's oriented to God, and God is his law. Whatever God says goes. So, in a series of articles on the members of the Supreme Court justices prior to John Marshall, all but one argued publicly that the court would could strike down an act of Congress if it violated natural law, which was based on morality and not a political wisdom. That's from Scott Gerber in his article, The Early Supreme Court. They applied these concepts to the legislative processes, the judicial system, and the standards for life. As John Adams indicated, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And the idea of this city set on a hill, this great experiment in Christianity, which it's failed, unfortunately. But they recognized that the citizens themselves had to be moral and that they had to participate in all of this. That you couldn't run a country filled with unrighteous idiots. That it didn't work that way. Well, their faith taught them that humans were sinful. Oh, no. We can't say that today. That was from John Adams, by the way, to the Massachusetts militia. In October 11, 1798. Their faith taught them that humans were sinful. Madison wrote in Federalist No. 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Well, that's pretty straightforward, I think. If angels were to govern men, neither internal, external, nor internal controls on government would be necessary. But however, righteousness does not prevail, does it? The angels aren't, men aren't angels, and men aren't ruled by angels. We are, unfortunately, to some extent, by the fallen angels. They are the powers, the forces in this world, to which men are subservient today. Well, Noah Webster said, you've heard of him probably, he wrote a little book. The Christian religion, in its purity, is the basis, or rather the source, of all genuine freedom in government. And I am persuaded that no civil government of a republican form can exist and be durable, in which the principles of religion have not a controlling influence. He also said the moral principles and precepts contained in the scriptures ought to form the basis of all our civil constitutions and laws. All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. Because again, if you're living under the law of Christ, you're not interested in crime and injustice and oppression and killing people. But sadly, of course, most of the people in our country nowadays are not. They are not consumed with learning the scriptures and living by them. And of course, faith without works is dead. If we don't live by them, all our talk is just that, talk. We have to put these things into play in our lives, even when it's difficult. That's where the real reward is. We talk about sharing in the sufferings of Christ. Well, the more difficult those sufferings, the greater the reward. And so, what's the natural human inclination for normal people? I don't want to suffer. Do you want to suffer? Let's all suffer. Nobody wants to suffer. Suffering is not fun. However, it is through many sufferings we must enter into the kingdom of God. We know that suffering isn't here just to beat us down. That there, number one, the helmet of salvation tells us, that's phase three salvation, by the way, tells us that there's an end to this. There's an end to our fight. Whether it's physical death or the rapture, there's an end to it. That we don't have to fight this fight forever. And if you get too bogged down thinking, oh, I've got to do this for the rest of my life, well, anything you look at that way is going to be burdensome. All I got to do is get up and apply doctrine today. Today is all I have. Frankly, yesterday's gone. It's over and done with. I can't change it. You can't change it. Tomorrow isn't here yet. So all I have to do is apply one day at a time. And just have that attitude of what next, Father? What next? What's next? What do you want me to do? What am I supposed to do next? And it may be rest. It may be quiet. It may be go do this, go do that, whatever it is. You pray about it. And God, I fully believe God, the Holy Spirit, wants to lead us if we're willing to listen. But there's so many things competing for your time and your attention up here. Here John Jay, the original Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, indicated that the Bible is the best of all books. Yes, try saying that now on the Supreme Court. For it is the Word of God and teaches us the way to be happy in this world and in the next. Continue, therefore, to read it and regulate your life by its precepts. End of class. We'll just stop right there. I couldn't say it any better. When you find these guys and you think, wow, these guys were not idiots. They really did. Some of them had a profound understanding of this stuff. And that's why, again, it's very difficult. And we've had to do both. We have to deal with Babylon as a golden cup and as this hammer that's crushing everything that's in its way. We have to deal with Babylon as a golden cup, but unfortunately it's filled with this toxic wine now that Babylon's freely passing out here. And so we're roofing the nations as we go, more or less. Get them under our control. Well, 25, under the basic principle of religious freedom, which many of the founding fathers advocated, Christianity has flourished in America to the point that this nation has had access to the truths of the gospel. There isn't a place probably in this country where you can go and you're not going to find a church on a corner somewhere. But where are you going to go and get away from religion in this country? It's all over the place. And not to say it's all good or right or any of that. I'm not advocating that. But what I am saying is it's available. And the fact that we make it so available. We put it out there freely on the internet for people to listen to if they choose to. Of course, they've got to orient to the hardness of the teaching just like you and I do. They don't need to sit there on the internet forever. Unless, obviously, in certain cases, God's got certain people where their niche, they can't change it. Now, there are people that have choices, could change their niche, and they won't. That's a whole different ballgame right there. That's a different type of volitional issue. But for people who can't change, they're married. And as a woman, you're not free to just up and leave because your husband's negative. You still got the principles of marriage. Now, on the other hand, obviously you have to stand up for the principles of the truth and say, okay, Bible class is the most important thing. This is what I'm going to do. And let the chips fall where they may. But on the other hand, you can't just up and run. But that's not the biblical answer. And many people, of course, try that. So that can get you in trouble. So people have had access to this. It's available now. It's freely available here in Sarasota. It has been for almost 30 years, 29 years next month. And we've held forth the word of life like we're supposed to. Holding forth the word of life. Giving the doctrine to believers to grow them up so that they can function as believer priests properly. And be blessed and grow to maturity and have the greatest of rewards for eternity. That's why we're here. And again, being organized and unified in those goals of pursuing the truth and applying the doctrine as we go. Being lights in the world, salt, these analogies, lights and salt, the lights don't say anything, you just see them. And that's the witness of the life. I live my life in a different way than these other people live their lives. I'm not back and forth on this. One week, oh, I hate God. The next week, oh, I love God. You know, I might get upset with God. Of course I have. Who hasn't? If you're honest and you won't admit it. You ever been upset with God? Oh, not me. Well, I've been upset with God, but I don't waffle on why am I going to serve you or love him or this or that. I may go through testing and fail, which we all do, but I'm not wishy-washy on this stuff. I'm not back and forth. I'm not 1 week for it, the next week against it. That manifests real instability. And that's not from God. That's from your enemies. Your enemies don't want you to be stable. They're going to work against making you stable, in fact. So those who study these things from a biblical perspective have often concluded that Christianity was the primary influence that provided the system that resulted in great blessings on America. And so again, there's no real easy answer here. You have biblical Christianity as a part of this. You certainly have, while it's not the primary factor, geography does influence things. But you have a system of capitalism, hard work, diligence, Protestant theology, and all of these things together formed this system that worked and was blessed. And God blessed it. See, God's a big fan of hard work. Go to the ant, you sluggard. God wants people to work and take care of themselves and all of that. And guess what? That was what I was taught early on. Like my dad, I told dad, I remember probably about 15, probably had my learner's permit or something. Said, I need a car. Dad said, good. You get a job, you can get a car. But you're going to have to also realize you're going to have gas and insurance and all this. So it isn't just getting the car. And he said, here's how you do it. You go get a job. And so I learned early on the value of hard work. Of a job well done. See, there's a certain satisfaction in this that people today don't get. I mean, to really do a job right, and even the more difficult it is, when you get it finished, there's a certain satisfaction in that. A soulish satisfaction. That God's blessed you and it was a job well done and all that. A lot of people don't have that today. They couldn't do a good job if they had to. But again, many of them are not trained. So this is the primary influence, again, that provided these great blessings. So in an article by Jim Dennison, he writes, a scholar from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences told a group of Westerners in 2002 that his group was asked to look into what accounted for the success. In fact, the preeminence of the West over all the world. And by the West, they meant the U.S. particularly. After dismissing views that our success was tied to our military, politics, or economic system, they concluded the heart of your culture is your religion, Christianity. And this is why the West has been so powerful. The Christian moral foundation of social and cultural life was what made possible the emergence of capitalism. And then the successful transition to, quote, democratic politics. Didn't care for that, but they're not going to get everything right. But largely what they said is correct here. This is what they figured out. We don't have any doubt about this. That's in an article there again. Why has God blessed America? Good question. Well, 28, thus it seems reasonable to conclude that the Christian faith, with an emphasis on reason and progress, combined with political freedom and the productivity of capitalism, to make Babylon a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. And that we have been, and to some extent still are, of course. Now, Facebook, they took quite a hit the other day. You know, you like it when how much ever, $100 billion disappears? Gotta love that. That's the joy of the stock market for you. Well, in the end, history indicates that this nation has been greatly blessed with religious and political freedom, which has resulted in tremendous economic prosperity that has made America the envy of most of the world. Again, you don't hear this problem in Mongolia or Russia about people trying to immigrate there too much. You don't have this going on, oh, let's immigrate to the Congo. Let's go to Somalia. That sounds like a good place. You don't hear people immigrating to third world nations. Why? Well, because they recognize this is the pinnacle at some level of what a nation can be. And they recognize this is a place to go to improve yourself, if you can. Well, however, it was that very blessing of financial prosperity that would become the downfall of the once godly, rational, powerful, and blessed nation. That's, unfortunately, the emphasis has become money. And it's the bottom line that we're concerned with. And every day I turn on the news and every day I hear, oh, the earnings are coming out. The stock market's this, the stock market's that. Why? Because the emphasis is all on money. And that's where most people spend their lives, worried about their money. And, you know, money's just a tool. So are most people. But money is just a tool. It is not good or bad in and of itself. The love of money is the problem. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evils. But not money itself. Money's, again, neutral. You can use it rightly, you can use it wrongly. You can make it all about you, or you can learn to live and make it all about others. In a Christian sense. Well, 31, although it may appear from the English translation that the golden cup intoxicates all the earth, the next statement indicates that it is the product within the cup that makes the world drunk. 32, the product that has been provided to all the nations is described in the book of Revelation as the wine of the passion of her immorality. With the word wine here being defined by the two genitives that follow in Revelation 18:3, and this, of course, is, again, passages with regard to prophetic Babylon. You have this genitive string in there that you have to account for. All the nations have fallen because of the wine of the passion of her immorality. So you have wines in the genitive, passions in the genitive, immoralities in the genitive. So this makes more complicated the understanding of it, how you're going to treat these. Well, while the string of genitives that follows has prompted a number of translations, what one can affirm is that the first genitive wine is what Babylon has provided for the nations to drink. And that's what's consistent there with our Jeremiah passage. Very same passage. So as one should be aware, while drinking is not a sin, drunkenness is. The Bible recognizes that wine is that which intoxicates. And sufficient wine will cause one to be disoriented. Genesis, this was one of the first, actually the first incident in Genesis 9 there. Following the flood. And people can endlessly debate, was Noah trying to get drunk? Did Noah not know what would happen? Was fermentation a fact before the flood? Questions that really can't be answered that I know of. I mean, maybe they can, but I don't see that when I look at the passage to think, well, that's what I really need to figure out. Here it's just straightforward, essentially. He drank of the wine and became drunk. And uncovered himself inside of his tent. Also, chapter 19. This one's a little less savory. This one's Lot and his daughters. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him so that we may preserve our family through our father. Now, while this is, again, incest, there's no other polite way to put this. This was not as uncommon during that time as one may think. Because of this emphasis on keeping bloodlines going. Still not appropriate. So they don't say, well, there's no law against it. Well, there wasn't a law against it at this point. The Mosaic prohibition came in later. So they made their father drink wine that night. And the firstborn went in and lay down. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. That's because he's drunk. But he's completely out of it. No memory of it. Also, Proverbs chapter 20. Solomon has some things to say. And I don't think there's any... I think there's probably evidence. To say that Solomon drank wine all the time, but he never got drunk, I'd say it'd be probably stretching it. How many people you know drink all the time and never got drunk? That's not... And Solomon was drinking good wine, too. He wasn't drinking. He had the best of the best. Proverbs 21, wine is a mocker. A strong drink is a brawler. And whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. And it brings up this matter of verbal bouts, mocking, verbal attacks and all of that. People get more aggressive. A strong drink is a brawler. Then you get into the physical aspect. People get drunk and then they want to fight. They're going to fight everybody. And, but that's obviously not appropriate. And again, it says you're not wise if you end up like this. Proverbs 23:20. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine, or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will close one with rags. Well, I drank wine, I had the wine with my lunch, and so I don't really feel like working now, so yeah. No, you don't. You know? And you don't even have to be drunk to let this stuff affect you in an adverse way. Obviously, drunkenness is the key element. And here he talks about this. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? That's conflicts, quarrels. Who has complaining? Self-pity and all of that that comes out of this. Who has wounds without cause? How many people have you seen that were drunk that fell down? And they woke up the next day and they said, where'd this come from? Ran into something. Some guy's fist, even. But people have these, and seriously, people who get blackout drunk, they don't know what they're doing. And falling is not unusual for them. Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste mixed wine. So everybody say, well, okay, I just won't drink wine. I'll drink Jack Daniels. Oh. Well, okay, that's not the point of this. It doesn't matter what the form of alcohol is. Whether it's beer, wine, vodka, whatever, whiskey, tequila, whatever liquor you want to drink, absinthe, pick it all. Pick any of them. Abuse of them is going to get you into trouble. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup. It looks good. When it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Your mind, hallucination's not unusual for people to get this way. And obviously, if you've ever been around a person when they're drunk, as we all probably have, they're not rational. They're not logical. And it's not fun dealing with them. And it stings like a viper. And your mind will utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea. Well, that sounds dumb. Now, I think that's saying this is dumb. Or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. I don't think you could. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I did not know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. And again, while I've gotten drunk, I've failed in this area, and I know it. And I've never made any secret of it or tried to hide it. And not taught this stuff because, I've been guilty of it, so therefore I can't teach you not to do this. I think I have to teach us all not to do it. And I just never understood the desire, though. This whatever I did, I never understood the desire to get up the next day and start drinking again. That part I didn't get. That is so unhealthy that it's not even funny. This does not work long term. So again, there you got this deal on drunkenness. The first question that must be asked here now is how the interpreter is to identify the wine that Babylon has offered the nations, and which they have willingly consumed to the point of a loss of equilibrium. So, again, we stress the guilt of Babylon in this, but the nations are not innocent. They want Uncle Sugar's money. They want the capitalist lifestyle. They want to benefit from all these good things. Now, can you blame them? If you lived in some third world country and had nothing, well, right now, you just go to Puerto Rico. And because that's largely all it's become now. The stuff's not getting fixed there. And why? Well, I don't know. I don't really care. But they'll take the money because they need it. They want it. They want this lifestyle. Well, clearly the passage here is not literal. It should be understood in a metaphorical sense. But again, just like drinking too much wine will make you drunk, taking in too much false viewpoint and human viewpoint and false doctrine gets you spiritually drunk. And you're not in touch with reality when you're spiritually drunk. And if your view isn't that God's right and all of this, well, you've come under whatever form of evil or influence that drags you down. Well, with that, we want to kick. The figure of drinking from the wine of someone can be used to denote a participation in the lifestyle or destiny of the one that's in view. Ezekiel 23. So participating with here has the idea also of fellowshipping with, and not just that they drank the wine, And they're happy to drink it. But here in another metaphorical passage, thus says the Lord God, you will drink your sister's cup, which is deep and wide. You will be laughed at and held in derision. It contains much. You will be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, the cup of horror and desolation, the cup of your sister Samaria. And then you will drink it and drain it. And this goes on to say, but essentially what he's saying is, you're going to suffer the same things the Samaritan suffered because you have participated in their lifestyle. Now you're going to participate in their judgment. And that's the idea here. Also, Mark 10, Jesus talked about this. This matter of the cup. 10:38. And Jesus said to them, you do not know what you're asking. This is when they tried to do the end run around the other disciples, James and John. And then in another passage says their mother did it too. Hey, would you make my boys great? And Jesus said, well, no. But in this, in John's or Mark's version here, he doesn't mention the mother being involved in this. So he said, what do we want? Well, we just want to sit in your glory. We just want to be right there, right hand and left hand. That's all we want. Just the premier positions of honor and prestige throughout your kingdom. That's all we want. We want to be number two and number three, and to hell with the rest of these guys. Whatever they get, we don't care. And that's how the disciples were. They were very combative, very trying to get ahead all the time. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Or to be baptized with the baptism with which I have baptized? And he said to him, we are able. And the cup here references his sufferings. Now, they're, to some extent, they're going to learn about his sufferings. They won't bear sins. And obviously, that baptism has to do with the sins of the world. Drinking of the cup had to do with the sufferings and all that went with it. But baptism really got into the matter of bearing sins. And he says, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And you will be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. And at some level, while they didn't suffer for sins, obviously they became a part of all of this. And they suffered for various things along with him. They just couldn't bear the sins of the world. And he said, you're going to participate with me in all of this at some level. That's the idea there of the cup. Well, in the end, it seems best to understand the wine to be a metaphor for the intoxicating effect that her immoral passion has on those she seduces, who ultimately succumb to her wiles and engage in fornication with Babylon. Using a sexual analogy here of what we're doing politically and economically and militarily in these other nations. But it's under that sexual analogy. So the figure in the wine is that which intoxicates and brings one under its control, or the wine in the figure. This points to the specific doctrines with which America has intentionally influenced the nations of the world. America has become a global leader and a promoter of a world controlled by money, technology, and corporate politics. The massive corporations are greedy for profit. And see, profit's not a bad thing. In a capitalistic system, profit is a good thing. But profit at what expense? If you have to compromise your morals to get money, that's not a good way to make profit. If you have to hurt people and destroy the environment to make money, that's not a good way to do it. And there should be, of course, at some level, some controls on this, because the fact is, capitalists, pure-blooded, dyed-in-the-wool, I'm a capitalist and all I care about is making money, they're not worried about some of the outflow of their activities or who it hurts. And that becomes a problem, where it's all about money and getting ahead. We don't care who it hurts. So the massive corporations are greedy for profit. The U.S. government has been instrumental in exporting capitalism, read democracy, to the nations of the earth. And 35, the promise to other nations is that they can enjoy the American capitalist lifestyle if they will simply cooperate with the American government and the corporate world. And unfortunately, again, this is what the nations want. But if you, again, put yourself in their place, you live in some third world backward country, the per capita income is $50 a year, wouldn't you want to improve that? Wouldn't you want out of there? So at some level, we have to say, well, the nations are drinking willingly. But again, some of it is because of their position. What the hands they've been dealt, as it were. Well, in order to intoxicate these nations, the globalists ply less developed nations with the promise of benefiting from American money, goods, and technology, which is designed to entice the other nations into cooperation. And although Babylon offers the wine, it is evident that the nations have willingly drunk from the cup that America has offered, and has been all too willing to accept and adopt its policies in order to share in the prosperity. But again, if it's all about money, then of course they're going to do this. This only makes logical sense if it's all about money. So the wine then refers to the things the globalists offer to the nations in order to intoxicate them and cause them to buy into the doctrines, which promise much to those being seduced, but which actually benefit those in charge, the globalists, the people at the top. And again, while we believe, and you got to be careful, as I've warned you, about this business of conspiracy theories and all of this. People are getting taken down by this stuff, this insanity. We understand from Psalm 2, there is a global conspiracy against the Lord in the last days. The nations are conspiring together. But a conspiracy by its very definition has to be small at the top. Very few people can know about it and be able to prove it. And so you don't have a conspiracy with 80 million people involved. Somebody would tip it. So this business of everything's a conspiracy. No, it's not. And if you are find yourself prone to reading internet conspiracy theories, stop it. Don't bother with this stuff. If we need to address it biblically, it'll come up in Bible class, as this has. I decided many months before I finished Romans that we were going to review this. And for us, really, to do it right the first time. I've never gone through all these passages in detail. Endless, tedious, graphic, mind-numbing detail of destruction and death and horror. It's a challenge to want to get into the study every day and see what new hell waits for me. What fresh hell is this? So, 39 here now, back to our verse, the final part of verse 7. Is introduced by the prepositional phrase al kain, literally on thus, which is used extensively in the Old Testament and has the force of on this account or for this reason. And a lot of times it is just translated there by the single English term therefore. So it is followed by the hithpolel form of the verb halal. That means going mad or going insane, which is found only 6 times in the Old Testament. And each time it has the idea of going or acting insane. 1 Samuel 21. I think this is King David here. 1 Samuel 21. And this is during the time in his life when Saul was trying to kill him. And so David was essentially running for his life, waiting for God to eventually deal with Saul. So he recognized that the king was God's anointed and David was not to lift his hand against him. And in the monarchy, that's correct. You don't. And I have some believers that I've talked with recently. They struggle because they say, well, our pastor's become a nut job and we don't want to lift our hand against the God's anointed. Well, he may not be God's anointed anymore. First, he's not a king. First, interpret this in context. This has to do with the king. The point is, you want to be careful when you're dealing with authorities, but to say, well, you've got to submit to every authority no matter how weird they get, that's nonsense. That's not true in marriage. You don't have to submit to your husband if he tells you to commit criminal activity. You don't have to submit to your husband if he tells you you can't go to Bible class. You don't have to submit to him if he says you can't pray. There are things, you have legitimate grounds, you can stand, take a biblical stand and say no. And the same thing's true in any area. Authorities can be bad. They can go nuts, unfortunately. We've seen it. However, again, that's why the jury's out on all of us. But here David is running for his life because Saul's trying to kill him. So he ends up in the Philistine territory, who were the sworn enemies of the Israelites. And David knew that they'd been making songs about him in Philistine, about how many Philistines he'd killed. So you might not want to visit that place where they're celebrating you for killing their people. They weren't actually celebrating it. But David took these words to heart, and he greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let the saliva run down into his beard. And Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen? That you have brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?" Hell no. No, absolutely not. So David, he did this. This is a part of, and God was obviously leading him, because they would have probably killed him. But it wasn't his time to die. And so David used his logic and said, "Hey, if I act like a nut job, they'll probably think I'm a nut job. That I've lost my mind." You can also see Jeremiah 25:16, and then 51:7 is our verse. So 41, in this case, the nations have drunk from the cup. That is, they have embraced the doctrines and policies the U.S. has exported around the world to gain and maintain their share of the good life that American capitalism offers them. And again, the system itself isn't the problem. The problem is in people's orientation to money. It's their thoughts about money and how they view it and what's important in life. And money is, again, just something that's to be used to advance God's plan. To live our lives, we all have to have money. We have to pay bills. Last time I checked, FPL doesn't take green stamps. I don't even think they make those anymore. But anyway. So 42, as they embrace the evils that come from the pursuit of money, details in the good life. They drink to the point that they descend into a state of confused and irrational thought. That is characteristic of drunken buffoons. The nations of the world, see, I had people come at me, when we were studying this in Revelation years ago, and say, "Well, this nation's no more guilty than the rest of the nations of the world." I know. It's maybe a little more culpable, had a little bit better founding than all of that. But it's not as though these nations in the world aren't going to get theirs. They're going to get it just a few months later. A couple of years, maybe. Not much. And so, but we are more culpable. And this is the problem. The nations now are all too willing to cooperate rather than live their own lives and take care of their own selves. But again, this matter of internationalism is going to be the death of the world, whether people admit it or not. All right, well, our time is gone. We got through that today. We'll be ready to move on with verse 8 on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.